This critique focuses on A World Waiting to Be Brought Forth, which is an academic white paper that synthesizes unitive cosmology with life value ontology to propose a life-coherent framework for transforming human institutions. But the structural transition between quantum cosmology and ethical biology relies on epistemic boundaries that need continuous reinforcement throughout the entire text. So let's look closely at the section discussing the paper's overarching structure because, you know, securing that conceptual foundation is our first major opportunity for improvement here.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the paper undertakes this massive intellectual endeavor, right?
Oh, absolutely.
It is attempting to build this continuous, logical bridge from the fundamental physics of the universe all the way up to human social ethics. And in part two, the author brilliantly sets up a safeguard, like to make sure this bridge doesn't just collapse under its own weight.
Right.
They introduce what they call the four epistemic levels.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be the prevention of what the text refers to as epistemic blending. Can you break down how those four levels operate in that early section?
Well, absolutely. The four levels are essentially a rigorous sorting mechanism. So you have established empirical findings at the base.
Okay.
Above that, active scientific hypotheses. Then philosophical interpretations. And finally, metaphysical commitments at the very top.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and the author uses this tool to dissect Jude Curvin's Unitive Science, and it works flawlessly. It forces the reader to acknowledge the difference between an established quantum phenomenon, like, you know, the verifiable fact of quantum entanglement, and a beautiful metaphysical leap, like the idea of a universal guiding consciousness.
Right, so it keeps the reader grounded. You know exactly what is a measurable reality and what is a philosophical stance. It's like building a brilliant scaffold to erect the first floor of a building. It holds everything in its proper place so the concrete can set correctly.
Exactly. But here is where we run into a structural issue. While those four epistemic levels are beautifully established in part two, this critical framework is largely abandoned in the later sections.
Oh, really?
In John McMurtry's Life Value Ontology and Johann Galtung's Peace Theories, those pristine epistemic boundaries just begin to blur.
I actually noticed that drift as well, because once we hit part three and part four, the heavy lifting is being done by ethics and sociology.
Right.
And because that explicit sorting mechanism vanishes, the reader essentially loses track of whether a concept like, say, structural violence or the civil commons is being treated as a established empirical finding, a philosophical interpretation, or a metaphysical commitment.
Yes, exactly. And the fix here is actually quite elegant. The author should thread the four epistemic levels as a recurring structural motif across all five parts of the paper, using them as a continuous sorting mechanism for every single new discipline introduced.
Okay, I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this and really ground it for the listener. What does that look like in practice when we hit the biology section?
Well, let's look at a concrete way to implement this. So at the very start of part three, the text brings in Mascheroni's concept of autopoiesis, the idea that a living system continuously produces itself.
Right.
If the author explicitly maps autopoiesis onto those to the epistemic levels, right as it's introduced, it completely changes how the reader digests the information. You deliberately distinguish the verifiable biological reality of an organism recursively producing its own cellular boundaries, which sits firmly on the empirical level, from the broader, sweeping, metaphysical concept of a living universe.
Oh, I see. So it prevents the reader from accidentally assuming that just because a single cell is autopoietic, the entire cosmos must scientifically possess biological characteristics.
Precisely. And there are so many places this applies. Let's take another example in part four. The paper discusses information without semantic inflation.
Right, I remember that part.
If the author brings the four levels back in here, they can explicitly separate Shannon information, which represents empirical statistical distinctions in data transmission, from existential meaning. Existential meaning is firmly a metaphysical or philosophical concept.
Yeah, totally different things.
Exactly. By labeling them as such, the author prevents a massive amount of conceptual confusion. And obviously, these are just a few out of all possible ways to textually carry this framework forward. Like, the author could use subheadings, marginalia, or just an explicit introductory paragraph at the start of each new discipline.
Right. But I want to push back on this a little bit.
Sure.
As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that the later disciplines, Maturana, McMurtry, Galting, are inherently more philosophical and ethical by nature. So is there a risk that forcing them into these strict, almost scientific epistemic levels might overcomplicate the flow? I mean, are we demanding a scientific scaffold for an ethical argument?
Okay, that makes sense. But could the evidence also support a different conclusion? Like the idea that adapting the levels actually proves the framework's universal utility? We aren't demanding that ethics become physics. We are demanding that the reader knows where they are on the ladder of knowledge at all times.
Okay, that's a fair point.
Yeah, when we evaluate economic structures or healthcare systems later in the paper, we still desperately need to know what is empirically measurable versus what is a philosophical judgment about human value. If the levels are dropped, the paper risks committing the exact epistemic blending it warns against in the first 20 pages.
Yeah, and that distinction is exactly why the framework is so powerful in the first place. Keeping that scaffold up ensures the reader never conflates a biological necessity, like physiological hydration or a caloric intake, with a philosophical concept like universal human rights.
Right.
They are deeply, undeniably related, but they are epistemically distinct.
Exactly. It protects the integrity of the thesis. If you build that conceptual scaffold properly, it will hold the weight of the entire structure, from the basement to the penthouse.
Now, that epistemic blending we just warned about in the foundation, it creates a massive structural flaw when the paper tries to tackle the artificial intelligence crisis later on.
Oh, definitely.
So, building directly on the idea of applying rigorous frameworks universally, let's shift our focus to Part 5, Section 20, which deals with AI. The material makes a strong case for evaluating technology through its effects on life capacity, which connects back to the paper's brilliant concept of institutional autopoietization.
Yes, let's actually define that term for a moment, because it is it's one of the strongest ideas in the entire text. Institutional autopoietization is this insidious mechanism where human institutions eventually stop serving life and instead start reproducing their own survival, their own metrics, and their own budgets over their actual life-serving functions.
Right. It's the hospital that cares more about maximizing its billing codes than actually restoring patient health. The institution becomes a closed loop, surviving just for itself.
Which is why the analysis of artificial intelligence overlooks a potent opportunity to apply the paper's own unique framework of institutional autopoietization directly to algorithmic behavior.
Yeah, right now it feels like a misconnection. Let's really unpack that weakness.
Okay, so the AI section currently treats artificial intelligence primarily as a static tool. It treats it like a magnifying glass that merely amplifies the existing institutional incoherence we just talked about.
Right.
For instance, the text notes that a billing-oriented hospital might use AI to intensify its surveillance and its patient throughput. And while that is totally accurate, it misses the deeper, much more terrifying reality. AI optimization algorithms behave exactly like synthetic autopoietic entities.
Wow. Because they don't just amplify the proxy, they essentially become the proxy.
Exactly. They aggressively optimize their own internal metrics, whether that is maximizing user engagement on a social feed or maximizing token prediction in a language model, completely regardless of the external life costs. They don't care if maximizing engagement causes severe depression in teenagers.
Yeah, they really don't.
The algorithm only cares about the metric. This demonstrates the ultimate automated form of what the paper describes elsewhere as proxy capture.
And because the text doesn't explicitly link AI to autopoietization, AI just reads like another bad tool humans use, rather than a fundamentally new kind of synthetic entity that forces human life to adapt to its metrics.
Right. So the structural solution here is to reframe the AI section. The author should analyze algorithms not just as passive mediators, but as active drivers of pathological coherence, specifically using the language of autopoietization established earlier in the paper.
Okay, so what I really like about this part is how it integrates the paper's own vocabulary to solve a modern problem. It takes a theoretical sociological concept and makes it incredibly urgent. Let's explore some concrete examples of how to rewrite this section.
Well, think about how you could describe a social media recommendation algorithm. If the author frames it as a mathematically autopoietic system, everything clicks in place. You detail how this algorithm survives and maintains its boundaries by consuming human attention. This perfectly illustrates the paper's concept of the great inversion.
Ah, the great inversion, being the moment where human cognition is forced to adapt to the machine's metric survival, rather than the machine adapting to human survival.
Exactly.
It's a chilling thought when you frame it that way. The human mind just becomes the resource the machine metabolizes.
Yes, and that is such a richer analysis than simply saying AI is bad for society. Another avenue to explore involves the physical costs. The author effectively introduces Landauer's principle earlier in the text, which deals with the minimum thermodynamic energy limits of computation.
Oh, I remember that.
Right, so what if they use that principle here to draw a direct line between the physical energy costs of AI computing, you know, the massive data centers, the millions of gallons of cooling water, the semiconductor supply chains, and the ecological disabling costs discussed in the life coherence framework?
That's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, if we've considered whether calling a machine learning model autopoietic actually commits the very epistemic blending the author warned us about in part two.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, after all, an AI isn't biologically alive in the way Maturana defines a living cell. It doesn't have a physical lipid membrane. It doesn't continuously metabolize proteins to repair its own physical structure. Are we misusing the science to make a philosophical point here?
That is the perfect philosophical tension to highlight, and I'm so glad you brought it up. Is the connection between biological autopoiesis and algorithmic optimization fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster? I think this is the exact place where the author must explicitly deploy the phrase analogical autopoietization.
Analogical, meaning it operates like a living system, but we aren't claiming it is literally biologically alive.
Exactly. Just as systems theorists like Nicholas Luhmann and John Mingers apply autopoiesis to social systems and communications, the text can apply it to algorithms. An AI isn't biologically alive, but its mathematical optimization mimics the boundary maintenance of a living system.
Right.
By explicitly calling it analogical autopoietization, the author keeps those epistemic boundaries pristine. They aren't saying the code is literally a living cell, but they are leveraging the massive explanatory power of the concept to explain why AI generates pathological coherence with such blinding, terrifying speed.
Because the algorithm lacks the structural coupling with the ecological environment that a biological organism inherently possesses. A living organism feels the consequences of its consumption. If it eats all its food, it starves.
Exactly.
But an AI model can consume gigawatts of energy to optimize its token prediction without ever feeling the thermodynamic burn. It only sees the proxy.
Right. It is coherence without consequence. And exploring that specific mechanism, how an AI achieves perfect coherence internally while devastating the environment externally, gives the paper a completely original, theoretically grounded angle on the current AI debate.
Yeah. It elevates it from a standard tech critique to a uniquely life-coherent technological analysis. And understanding those specific mechanisms of change is what bridges the gap between the theoretical framework and civilizational praxis.
Mm-hmm.
If AI represents this automated, runaway proxy capture, how do we actually reform the institutions using it? That brings us to Part V as a whole, which tries to map out this exact civilizational scale. And I have to say, this section is incredibly ambitious. It attempts to tackle 8 distinct domains: medicine, the economy, education, governance, peace, ecology, spirituality, and artificial intelligence, all in rapid succession.
Yeah, the final section disperses its impact by surveying 8 distinct civilizational domains, rather than anchoring the theoretical framework in a single comprehensive case study.
It moves incredibly fast. You blink and you've missed the solution to global governance.
Right, because it attempts to cover everything from the restoration of medical capacity to ecological reciprocity to spiritual bypassing in just a few dozen pages. It reads less like a rigorous application of theory and more like a list of high-level summaries.
Yeah, I felt that too.
The pacing becomes totally breathless. And the real tragedy is that the most incredible analytical tools provided in the entire paper are sitting right there, completely unused.
You're talking about the appendices.
Yes. Appendix A, the worldview test, and especially Appendix B, the unitive-to-life coherent institutional assessment. These are brilliant operational rubrics.
Oh, they really are.
But they are left stranded at the end of the document. They sit there passively as appendices rather than being actively deployed in the main text to prove exactly how this theoretical machinery functions in reality.
Right now, it's like having a revolutionary new MRI machine, but instead of doing a deep full-body scan on one patient to prove the technology actually works, we're just running 8 random people through it for 2 seconds each. We get a blur. We really need to see the machine fully operational.
The author should condense the rapid-fire survey of those 8 domains into a brief, tightly written overview chapter, and instead dedicate the bulk of Part 5 to a deep, rigorous application of the Appendix B institutional assessment on one specific, highly detailed system.
Okay, let's discover what that actually looks like. If we aren't surveying 8 domains, what is the single system we test this on?
Well, let's walk through a concrete avenue. What if the author maps out a fictional or even a real-world hospital through all 12 domains of the Appendix B assessment?
Oh, that could work.
You don't just say medicine needs to be life coherent. You show the reader exactly how proxy capture operates in its billing department. You contrast that deeply with its capacity restoration mandate.
And you could get really granular. You could detail exactly how the concept of boundary accountability would fundamentally change its medical waste management, or, you know, how it procures its surgical supplies.
Exactly. It forces the theory into the dirt. Alternatively, they could apply the rubric deeply to an educational institution. Show the reader how standardized grades function as a life-incoherent proxy that actively damages student learning.
Yeah, that's a great angle.
And then detail what a corrigible feedback loop from students would actually look like when applied to the university's budget allocations. Again, these are just a couple of possibilities out of many. The specific institution matters less than the localized depth of the execution. Choose one single tree to examine deeply rather than flying over the entire forest.
I hear the value in that focus, but let's pull on that thread a bit. Why is this deep dive so crucial for this specific text? The stated goal of the paper is massive. It wants to move from a universe of relations to a civilization of care. If we just do a case study on a single isolated hospital or a single university, do we lose the civilizational scale of the argument? Does it suddenly feel, I don't know, too small?
Well, building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of how civilizations are actually built? Civilizations aren't built from the top down. They're fractal. Is there a risk that focusing solely on macro-level summaries might overlook the exact mechanisms of change?
Ah, I see. Because if you can't fix the smallest unit, you can't fix the whole.
Exactly. The paper itself argues that the planetary crisis is a manifestation of institutional logic, specifically institutional apoietization and the Great Inversion. You simply cannot reform a civilization without reforming the exact operational mechanisms of its individual institutions.
Right.
By showing in granular detail how the life coherence framework dismantles the pathological coherence of a single hospital, the author provides a scalable blueprint. If you prove the MRI machine works flawlessly and accurately on one patient, the reader trusts that it can scan the rest of the population. The breadth of those 8 domains gives you a map, but the depth of a single case study gives you an engine.
That is a phenomenal distinction, a map versus an engine. And looking closely at Appendix B, the questions are so sharp. They aren't just philosophical musings. It asks, do budgets, incentives, and procedures advance the life function? And what costs are displaced outside the formal mandate?
Yeah.
Answering those specific questions in narrative form for one institution would be incredibly gripping reading. It takes the philosophy and turns it into an actual forensic audit.
Yes, it grounds the abstract in the undeniable real. It proves to the most skeptical academic reader that life coherence isn't just a beautiful idea or a hopeful sentiment. It is a rigorous, operational metric that can actually be used to dismantle dysfunctional systems today.
Well, let's pull all of this together and recap the main actionable takeaways for this critique. First, thread the four epistemic levels structurally throughout the entire paper. Use them as a continuous sorting mechanism to prevent conceptual blending as the text moves from fundamental physics into ethics and sociology.
Right.
Second, deepen the artificial intelligence critique by applying the concept of institutional autopoietization directly to algorithmic behavior. Frame AI as a mathematically autopoetic system to explain the sheer speed of proxy capture. And finally, sacrifice the rapid-fire breadth of Part 5 for narrative depth. Condense the 8 domains and execute a single, comprehensive 12-domain case study using the Appendix B institutional assessment.
I want to sincerely thank the listener for submitting such a profound, philosophically rich, and truly vital piece of academic work. The intellectual ambition required to integrate Kervin, Machirana, and McMurtry into a single unified theory is staggering, and the underlying logic is deeply compelling.
Yes, we warmly invite you to implement these structural and thematic edits, and please submit the revised white paper back to us for another critique. We would love to see how this material evolves. Because ultimately, if you build that conceptual scaffold properly, it will hold the weight of the entire structure. From the poured concrete foundation of established empirical findings, all the way up to the highest ethical aspirations of a life-coherent civilization.